Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you once again on this Saturday morning. And it's going to be an interesting show, to say the least. There are a lot of things we really want to tackle here. And my guest today is going to be Dr. David Banik. He's been a guest on our show many times before. He's an associate professor of medicine at the University of Connecticut. And more importantly, he's head of the infection prevention program at the university. And if anything has dominated the news, it has been infectious diseases right now. You know, I started thinking about this, and when you think about what could end the world, right, and what could drive us into an apocalypse, right? I mean, globally, I'm not just saying this country or this town, but there are basically just three things that can do it, right? Changes in climate or pollution, okay? I mean, anything, if we use up all the oxygen we have or destroy the ozone layer completely, that would pretty much end the world as we know it. Infection, right? Widespread infection. We had a taste of it. Although many of us have short memories, we had a taste of it with COVID. But a widespread infection that we can't fight, again, would pretty much end the world as we know it. And the third reason would probably be a nuclear war. Right now, of those three things, there are people in power, not just in this country, although we're the country everybody looks at, but there are people in power who deny that two of those three things are even a factor. And that scares me. That actually frightens me, that there are people out there who have been elected in power and deny that two of those three things are important to us. So today, we're going to see what we can do about at least one of those things being infection, right? What are the infections that we see on the horizon? How are we, and the question for Dr. Banik, and I know it's going to be a tough one, is how do we protect ourselves individually as best we can as we're dealing with things? And these public health things, we're seeing measles now, right? With this outbreak in Texas. We have tuberculosis in Kansas City. Tuberculosis in the United States of America? I mean, I realize tuberculosis is the number one infectious disease that causes death worldwide, but not in the United States. I thought we were done with polio, but I think we're going to see a comeback. And right now, we are dealing with a bird flu, and let's not take that for granted. This bird flu is impacting everyone's economy, not just the price of goods or the price of eggs, right? But as people become sick, not just with bird flu, but there's an inability to work, and that affects the economy as well. And the organizations that we support to protect us, right, are being put on the back burner. The CDC, the World Health Organization. And one of those in particular I want to talk about is USAID, the United States Agency for International Development. Now, you're hearing a lot of stories, right? We're talking about waste in government. That's been the buzzword now. There's a lot of waste in government. Nobody's going to argue. There's a lot of waste, not just in government, but in all organizations, whether it be the place you work, right? It could be your hospital, could be your church. I mean, there's waste. But overall, you have to look at, is this organization, is this business accomplishing its mission? So overwhelmingly, have we overwhelmed the waste by our productivity? We talk about efficiency. We talked about it last week. The efficiency is how well a system can work, a motor, anything like that, based on the amount of work put in. So We're going to talk about USAID because I have personal experience with USAID. And let me bring you up to speed. In Haiti, where I work with Father Rick Frechette, who has been a guest on this program many times, we were able to build a hospital after the earthquake. Right? We already had the St. Damien Hospital, a pediatric hospital, but next to it, we're able to build the St. Luke Hospital. The St. Luke Hospital was funded in a large part by USAID. Now, when we talk about a hospital here, everybody's thinking St. Francis, Hartford Hospital, Yale. A hospital in Haiti is essentially a butler building, okay, that it's a rudimentary structure, okay, that has patient rooms, treatment rooms, a place to do procedures, but more importantly, an emergency room and a CT scanner. That hospital was built in large part by the work of USAID. It is currently among, if not the only, working hospital in Port-au-Prince, right? The general hospital has been shut down by the gangs. So all the gunshots, people burned, people having accidents, are coming to this one hospital that was funded by USAID. So when you look at waste in an organization, you also look at what good has come out of it. So from a personal standpoint, I'm dismayed that we've closed USAID. We've essentially thrown out the baby with the bathwater. And I think that's probably the best analogy here. So there are good things. Things need to be looked at. Could there be ways of cutting back on waste? Absolutely. But do you end all that aid? And don't forget, that's aid. We're feeding the hungry in Africa. Now there's food just sitting there rotting because there are no workers for USAID to distribute the food. There are HIV beds. There are vaccines that are given worldwide that protect all of us. And we're going to talk about that with Dr. Banik today, is how does global health affect our health here in Connecticut? Not just the United States, just right here in our neighborhoods. Why do we need to be concerned about global health? And especially when we're facing all these infectious diseases. So we're going to be chatting quite a bit about that today, to hopefully give everyone, and the purpose of this program is to provide good science so that you can take something from this show and apply it to your own lives and keep yourself and your families safe. So with that, we're going to be chatting with Dr. Banik. This day in medicine, February 15, 1829, Dr. Silas Weir Mitchell was born, also known as S. Weir Mitchell. He was probably the first neurologist in this country. During the American Civil War, he was a surgeon and a neurologist. He founded and really became, I guess, for lack of a better term, the spiritual leader of American neurology. And his descriptions of injuries still hold up today. We hear about reflex sympathetic dystrophy. We spoke with Dr. Sibersky about complex regional pain syndrome. S. Weir Mitchell was the one who first described that in the Civil War when soldiers were shot and had penetrating trauma from bullet wounds and their nerves healed in an abnormal way, creating constant pain. He also looked at the relationship between eye strain and headache, right? How many times have we seen that? Right, people who need glasses, they've got chronic headaches, but it's because they've been straining their eyes and they needed glasses. He looked at that in the 19th century. He also looked at an association between pain and weather. And we've all heard that, right? I know the weather's changing because my knees hurt, my hands hurt, my shoulders hurt. He was the first one who really explored that. So again, we remember Dr. Silas Weir Mitchell today as the day he was born in 1829. Last mention, I wanted to talk a little bit. I didn't get to finish talking about peripheral neuropathy last week as a result of James's questions. So we talked a little bit on peripheral neuropathy about how to make a diagnosis, its causes, and caused by toxic, metabolic, and hereditary conditions. But basically, it's either a loss of sensation or pain in peripheral nerves in your hands and feet. And age is a factor. We also talked about chemotherapy and chemotherapies and other medications that can cause it. So how do you diagnose it? Well, a really good neurologic exam does it. You want to test for vibratory sensation, pinprick temperature, all these different senses in the feet and in the hands. You know, a lot of people don't like taking their shoes off when they go to the doctor, but if you take your shoes and socks off, you can look at the most distal, the longest part of the nerve down in the feet. By checking different types of sensation, you're also testing different fiber types. You also want to test reflexes and strength, but the test that gives you the most information about peripheral nerve injury is the electrodiagnostic study, nerve conduction studies, and EMG, which is a test I do on a daily basis, because it will tell you if there's nerve injury, where there's nerve injury, and how bad that nerve injury is. Now, in terms of treatment, let's get right into it. The most important things to do are, first, caution. Caution from the standpoint that when providing foot care, if you have neuropathy and or have vascular problems in your feet, you don't want to injure your feet by cutting your own toenails and things like that. Seeing a podiatrist or having it done professionally is important. But also being able to walk. We need sensation in our feet to keep our balance. So if you're walking in a dark area like a dark restaurant or you're at a party and leaving late at night, or even just walking on an uneven surface, it would be wise to use an assistive device. Bring a cane or a walking stick. From a medication standpoint, and again, we've had this chat with Dr. Siberski on this program, you attack it from four different levels. One, topicals. So many people get relief by applying capsaicin cream on their feet to get relief from the pain, causing it to become numb. You could also use lidocaine patches. A transductive medication like gabapentin or other anticonvulsant medications work pretty well for this. And then you could have moderation using tricyclic antidepressants that also work in how these impulses, these pain impulses, are perceived in the brain. We call these sensations paresthesias. They're perversions of sensation. So some people feel like things are crawling on their feet or hands or burning, even though they're not on a hot surface. So again, you want to change those perceptions to some degree. Anyhow, I appreciate the question coming in. And obviously, if you have questions for me here, just reach out to me at info@alessimd.com. Next up, we're going to be chatting with Dr. David Banik from the University of Connecticut. So if you have questions for him that you'd like answered live, again, you can get them to me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back with my guest today, Dr. David Banik. Dr. Banik is an infectious disease specialist at the University of Connecticut and an associate professor of medicine. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dr. Ashley, for having me back.
I apologize for all the commercials there. They're trying to pay as many bills as they can around here. But let's get right back. Let's get right into it. We have a few minutes before the bottom of the hour. Let's touch on what's the update on flu, COVID, RSV right now? Why are we having such a bad year with flu and so many people out with it?
So, I think this is a good question. You know, I think, you know, year to year, we see a lot of variability in terms of these respiratory viruses. This year's flu season has been particularly severe, probably the worst in about a decade or so. I mean, I think we don't really have a complete understanding as to the exact reason. Some of it may be environmental, you know, some weather changes. Some of it may be matched with the vaccine. And some of it may be, you know, vaccine rates in general. So I think, you know, probably multiple factors, environmental and sort of transmission related as well.
Do we still see where people have more of an attenuated course of the flu if they've gotten the vaccine?
So, you know, I think this is also a little difficult to interpret in real time. You know, often we collect that data after the flu season is over and can get a better assessment. But, you know, I think in general, we do see that those who've gotten the flu vaccine do get a milder illness than those who haven't. You know, and I think that would be expected to be occurring right now. Again, we don't have a full answer to that until the end of the season when we can look kind of in hindsight as to how the vaccine performed in general. But in general, that is the message, and that is what we see that in clinically, that those who are vaccinated do have milder illness.
Are we back to a normal winter in the sense that flu is a bigger problem than COVID?
I think we are seeing that this winter. You know, I think COVID is a little challenging in terms of seeing kind of variability in terms of the transmission. You know, some seasons tend to be worse than others. So, you know, tough to predict whether we're in kind of a normal time period, but it does seem like influenza was a much bigger impact than COVID has been during this past winter.
Have we seen more hospitalizations this year from flu than we do see in other years?
We have, you know, not too unexpectedly. I think, you know, if we see more cases, more transmission, we're going to see more folks that are hospitalized with flu, and that has been the case this year. You know, I don't think we can say that it was a higher proportion of individuals who had flu that got hospitalized, but just overall numbers, higher rates of flu transmission occurring in the community is going to result in higher numbers of individuals who are hospitalized with flu, and that has been the case this season.
How about RSV, respiratory syncytial virus? Has that been a factor?
It has. You know, we have been seeing RSV circulate. I think RSV this year peaked a little bit earlier. So around November, December, we saw kind of a predominance of RSV relative to flu and COVID and other respiratory viruses. That has quieted down a little bit January, February, where flu has really become predominant. You know, we are still seeing some RSV, but the numbers are lower than what we had seen in the early parts of the winter.
When should people be thinking about their next round of vaccination for these illnesses? Like RSV, you only get once, correct?
That's right. Yeah, at this point, the RSV is a one-time vaccine, and individuals who are eligible for it, I do encourage them to get vaccinated for RSV. You know, at this point, it's a one-time dose, but that may change in the future as we learn more about the longevity of the protection from the vaccine. As far as flu vaccine, you know, there still is flu vaccine available. You know, I do still encourage folks to get vaccinated. And it's expected that even if we do start to see decline, there will still be transmission going on in the weeks ahead, and there may still be some protection available. So not too late to get a flu vaccine if you haven't gotten one yet. And then the COVID vaccine, still kind of some fluctuation in terms or some changes with regard to recommendations. It seems like the COVID vaccine is going to be a vaccine that's updated annually, similar to flu vaccine. So I expect there'll be a new vaccine available in the fall. But some individuals, particularly the higher risk groups, can get vaccinated more frequently, like every 6 months. So something that you'd want to touch base with your doctor and kind of look at your own specific situation.
Sounds good. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. David Banik. We're going to start talking a little bit about the bird flu, okay, that's been going around and now crossing over in species, tuberculosis, and really give you some hints on what you can do personally to stay healthy around these infectious diseases. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. My guest today is Dr. David Banik. And we're chatting about infectious diseases and how they affect all of us here in this country. But one of the things we've been hearing an awful lot about, David, has been bird flu. Can you talk to us a little bit about the bird flu and how this all developed?
Sure. So when we talk about bird flu, we're referring to a specific subtype of flu, strain, if you will. Called H5 flu. So, you know, each year we see different strains circulating in humans. This is a very specific one called H5 based on some the characteristics of the particular virus. And this one circulates primarily in birds and has been circulating in birds. We've known about this for a long time. I think we would, in the last couple of decades, we've seen rare situations in which a human became infected, usually or almost always related to an infected bird. And they've been occurring like in various parts of the world sporadically. But what we've seen this past year is increasing numbers of cases, both in birds here in the U.S. and across the world, as well as in other animals, including cattle. So there was a big outbreak in cattle that started last fall of this particular strain of H5 influenza that we typically see in birds. And now we've seen cases in humans. The cases in humans have been relatively small in number and have almost always been directly linked to exposure to an infected bird or animal. But when we start to see different species infected with this type of strain that typically circulates in birds, it raises some concern about the potential for spread much more broadly.
Well, Doc, this is Joey. Dr. Alessi seems to be having some technical issues. One thing I wanted to get into is, like, how common is it to be transferred to humans? Hey, Doc, looks like Dr. Alessi is actually having some connection issues. How worrisome should we be from this to jump to humans from the bird population?
So, at this point, the infections that we've seen have occurred in pretty small numbers, but it's something that we definitely have to keep an eye on. So, we've seen cases here in the U.S. where humans who have been in contact with infected birds have gotten sick. Unfortunately, we didn't have one death from this. But I think in the big picture, at the moment, the risk to humans is low, and we aren't seeing human-to-human spread, which is a key thing. So if we start to see human-to-human transmission, that changes the overall risk profile in terms of the general public. But at this point, we're seeing small numbers of cases that are generally linked to exposure to birds, but it's definitely something that as sort of a public health system, and we need to really keep a close eye on and ramp up our surveillance systems to be able to identify if we start to see changes in the way that it's spreading.
One of the things that changed was we just heard about this transmission between species, and the CDC was a little bit late in publishing that information. Is that going to affect things now that we're starting to see it crossing over from birds to cattle to now farmers?
Yeah, I think it's a little hard to predict what this means in terms of the future. It does raise it to sort of a higher level of concern when we start to see spread with different species. I think the key will be whether we see human-to-human transmission, which hasn't been identified at this point. But anytime that we start to see different species transmitting and becoming infected with a strain that we typically see in birds, that does, sort of heighten the awareness that we need to really keep an eye on this and see if we start to see more changes.
Are we going to see it more and more each year? I mean, it's obviously affected a lot of things. I mean, all you got to do is ask somebody who wants to buy eggs. But in general, obviously, it's affected the fowl population in terms of making chickens available, things like that. Are we going to be seeing more and more of it?
I think with these viruses, things can be a little difficult to predict. We see some factors that would make us, think that there may be potential for more spread. The increasing globalization, increasing trade, increasing, sort of movement of birds and animals, those kinds of things do raise some concern that this is going to be something that's going to be challenged, that we're going to be challenged with in the future. But there are, things that in a public health community we can do to really try to slow this down. Sort of understanding where the spread is occurring, being able to address it. Right now there's measures in place that if we do identify infected birds, particularly infected birds like in a farm, we make sure that we can address that to try to prevent further spread. So there are things that in a public health sense we can do to try to reduce the impact of this. But, it may be the kind of thing that, we start to see become an ongoing challenge, but we just don't know at this point.
When you say we, from a public health standpoint, are we talking about the Department of Agriculture or the FDA?
Yeah.
Or who oversees this stuff?
Yeah, I think there's multiple groups that are involved. So, from the The animal perspective, you know, the Department of Agriculture is really key, and they track this very closely. And you can even go to, you know, the USDA and Department of Agriculture websites and get updated information on what's happening in the animal population. So we need to ramp up our animal surveillance, but also our human surveillance as well. Yeah, we need to be able to detect human cases, and that's actually happening right now. So the CDC put forth a requirement, or a message to public health laboratories that we need to be testing for H5N1 subtype on a more frequent basis. And they're ramping up their capacity and encouraging other labs to do that in human populations. So that'll help us be able to detect whether we see changes in the number of these H5N1 cases in humans, and we'll be able to you know, understand that and respond accordingly. So I think both on the animal side and on the human side, increasing surveillance and public health awareness is going to be critical.
Okay, I'd like to know which department it is in case they're disappearing tomorrow. So let's move right over to tuberculosis. Wow, this one floored me. I mean, a recent outbreak in Kansas City. You know, a lot of physicians probably never seen tuberculosis. I mean, I've seen it in Haiti. But can you talk a little bit about tuberculosis and the vaccine for tuberculosis?
Sure. So tuberculosis, I mean, it's still a global challenge. You know, we don't see it here in the U.S. very frequently. In fact, almost all the cases we've seen have been related to folks that most likely were infected overseas in countries that have higher rates of tuberculosis transmission. So here in the U.S., it's been pretty uncommon. I think, you know, this last report from Kansas, I think, raised some questions. Yeah, it was basically Kansas detected a significant increase in tuberculosis cases in their state, including ones that raised concern about domestic transmission here in the U.S. So, you know, I think, you know, we have to be mindful of tuberculosis. You know, in general, still relatively uncommon infection here in the U.S., but we have to be mindful of this, you know, potential for changing, you know, with a global world. You know, it doesn't take much to start to have disease transmission that we typically saw in other parts of the world here in the U.S. So, you know, I think it's something we certainly need to be mindful of, and we need to be able to support our public health response to tuberculosis cases, because tuberculosis is one of those infections that with appropriate public health measures, we can really reduce local transmission, but we do need that does require a significant investment in public health. As far as the vaccine, so there is a vaccine that's available in other parts of the world, that's called the BCG vaccine. You know, we don't really offer that here in the U.S. Because the rate of transmission of TB is so low that it's really not deemed to be beneficial. But you know, I think something that you know, we'll need to be thinking about if we start to see increasing rates of TB and TB transmission here in the U.S.
Are there parts of the country where you're more likely to see it? For example, they used to say, when I was training in New York, I mean, we used to say, well, if it's TB, you're probably going to get it on the subway. But so do you see it more in highly that's why I was a little surprised at Kansas City. I mean, although it's a city, I mean, it's not a major metropolitan area like New York or like Boston. Would you see it more in places like that, like New York or Boston?
Well, I mean, I think the key thing is that most of the TB cases, almost all the TB cases here in the U.S. are acquired overseas. They're in people that are either moving to the U.S. or traveling to the U.S. So it's still quite rare to see domestic transmission. You know, I think in terms of the potential exposure, you know, perhaps in cities where there are higher numbers of people that are coming from countries where there's high rates of TB, you may see more cases of TB. That's not surprising. I mean, in New York City, you know, those and like L.A., those places do have higher rates of TB. But again, most of it is among foreign-born individuals. But I think, you know, when we start to see local transmission, we need to be, you know, thinking, you know, what is sort of the why is this occurring now? You know, what are the types of populations that we need to be particularly attentive to, you know, here in the U.S. that may have higher rates of TB, and what can we do to try to prevent spread? Yeah, I think it's important to know that TB, even though it's contagious, it typically requires, you know, a longer, more intense period of exposure and then casual contact. Then you may think about, you mentioned the subway. I think that would be a lower risk situation versus someone that was in a longer environment. You know, we worry most about household transmission or transmission among individuals that have prolonged contact. So I think the key message right now is that the risk of acquiring TB here in the U.S. is still quite low. But certainly something that we need to invest in understanding and addressing when it occurs, because we can block transmission with public health measures.
Yeah, I mean, historically, I mean, it used to be a big issue. I remember Uncas on Thames Hospital in Eastern Connecticut used to be a TB sanitarium where people went. So we had, we would isolate the population. So it has been a big problem in the past. So we need to keep an eye on that. Let's move on. There's this outbreak of measles in Texas, and they're saying it's the worst outbreak in 30 years. Can we talk a little bit about that? I mentioned a little bit on the show last week, and now, I mean, it seems like it's just increased by an order of magnitude. Now there's 48 cases, 13 people hospitalized. What's going on?
So, yeah, I mean, measles is something that, I think over the last decade or so, we've seen increasing frequency of outbreaks occurring. You know, measles, in contrast to TB, is something that's highly contagious. It spreads very easily. I think the major explanation is really that we have a population that hasn't been exposed to measles, certainly the younger population, and vaccine is really the main way that we have prevented outbreaks and spread of measles among younger groups, and particularly children. And in pockets of the country where we see low measles vaccine rate uptake, I think that is where we're seeing outbreaks occurring. And so I think that is, something that's, we have to really be mindful of when we think about what's happening with childhood vaccinations and, really be supportive of these vaccines, particularly the measles vaccine, if we have low pockets of vaccination, we can expect to see transmission occurring.
So let's talk about that. In this particular situation, it was a close-knit Mennonite community in Texas, but yet their religion has made it, they were pretty emphatic that their church is not the reason they weren't vaccinated. I mean, you deal with these people all the time, these folks who are anti-vax or afraid of vaccines. What's the thing that's driving? Is it the internet that's driving these folks? Or I just don't get it. Okay, maybe I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, trying to support vaccination is something that, we do work with and we are sort of challenged with. I think, there's a lot of challenges, a lot of information that's accessible to the public, and it creates a lot of confusion as far as sort of the risk-benefit profile of vaccinations in general. And I think a lot of these infections, we haven't seen here in the U.S. for decades, so there's some memory loss as far as the impact that they can have on the community. So, we don't see an infection like measles for decades, largely attributable to vaccination. When we lose sort of understanding of what the true impact of the infection really is, and that we do see folks that have severe illness and, even people that die from measles. So, I think there's some of that coupled with some information that's, challenging and often inaccurate that's circulating. And, I think that's all contributing to lower vaccine uptake than we need to really provide that protection as a community.
Talk about a short memory. Most people don't even remember COVID and how devastating that was, not only on our economy, but how many lives were lost in this country. But I think that, measles seems to be taken somewhat lightly and shouldn't be. That's for sure. And I'm hoping we can turn those things around. I want to move on a little bit to a little bit more global issue, and that is HIV infections. I've always felt that we won a major battle, right? So I remember HIV when we first started seeing AIDS in the early 80s, late 70s. And it's just, it's an interesting story from a public health standpoint on how so many different areas came together to defeat this, and especially worldwide. I mean, we don't see it much. We see commercials for different drugs here in the United States, but there's not necessarily this same access in other countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. Can we talk a little bit about HIV in general and the treatments for it and what's going on globally?
Sure. So, I mean, I think HIV is something that I feel like may not be getting the public health attention that it really needs. I mean, I take care of many patients with HIV in our practice. And the overall prognosis for HIV is tremendous. So right now, if an individual is diagnosed with HIV, started on medication, they're much more likely to die from other causes like heart disease and, you know, things that the rest of the population is at risk for than HIV. In fact, their lifespan is expected to be the same as someone without HIV. So the medications are incredibly effective. And now, you know, you have medications that are even easier to take. So certainly almost all of our patients are on one pill once a day, which is a big contrast to what they what the medications had been even, you know, a decade or two ago. So, you know, I think the medications are incredibly effective and they work and they reduce they improve the lifespan and the overall life of patients who do have HIV, and also prevent transmission for those whose virus is suppressed while on medication. So I think they have the tremendous, they've seen tremendous benefit, and the science has really been incredible. But I think, as you mentioned, the big challenge is getting the medications or to people that need it, particularly in other parts of the world. So, you know, we do see very high rates of HIV transmission in other parts of the world, particularly, you know, you mentioned sub-Saharan Africa, and that's a big challenge. And, you know, getting their resources available to both sort of test patients and diagnose patients who do have HIV and then start them on treatment and maintain them on treatment has been a limitation. And I think it continues to be a limitation. And, you know, that's the kind of challenge that's going to really prevent the end of the HIV epidemic, which is something that, from a scientific perspective, we have the tools to get to. But I think from the public health support and infrastructure and being able to get medications to those who need it throughout the globe, I think we're still challenged with that. You know, we made some great strides globally with programs like PEPFAR and you know, other sort of global collaborations that have helped get HIV care to parts of the world that need it, but we're still challenged with that. But I think you know, we need to keep our eye on that as a major public health investment, and if we're going to see progress in the HIV epidemic.
You know, I want to make a note here. You know, we're very fortunate that we live in the state of Connecticut, and let me explain why. We have programs here through the Department of Social Services that I've worked with called the Working Disabled. So previously, people who had HIV couldn't afford their drugs, so they would have to leave their job. They had a job, right? These are people who have jobs. They would have to leave their job so that they could go on Husky and get their drugs paid for. Here in Connecticut, we have a program called the Working Disabled, in the sense that people can work and still get the support financially and get the medication so that they can continue being productive. And that's a goal. So I want people to understand that. These are not just people sitting around you know, on a welfare plan and not working. But I want to get back to it, because I'm sure there are people saying, okay, this is a problem in sub-Saharan Africa. Why do I care here, sitting here in Connecticut? And I'd like you to talk a little bit about that as to why we need to care.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and I'm glad you mentioned that here in Connecticut we do have tremendous support available for individuals with HIV. We have programs that eliminate all the barriers for medication, obtaining medication, and really also some that help support individuals with HIV to maintain healthy and highly functional lives. And I think we're very grateful for that. Other states are not as fortunate as Connecticut. to have such support. But, you know, I think getting to the global issue, you know, I think if we're ever going to see reduction and an end of the HIV, a reduction in transmission, end of the HIV epidemic, it's really, you know, as long as we're still seeing high rates of cases in other parts of the world, we live in a global world, you know, we're going to see infections occurring here in the U.S. You know, we can do all we can to try to help treat those individuals who are living here in the U.S., but we live in a global world. And, you know, what's happening in other parts of the world, you know, other continents throughout the world, you know, is going to impact us here. You know, we're going to see folks, you know, that are traveling and acquire HIV in other parts of the world that are coming to the U.S. And, you know, that's going to be a big challenge for us to see in terms of ending the epidemic. So, you know, I think it is important to support our domestic programs and certainly our state programs, and they do make, you know, a tremendous impact on individuals and the population here in Connecticut. But we can't be so narrow focused that we're only looking here in Connecticut, because what happens throughout the world is going to have an impact here in the U.S. and, you know, it's going to affect the health of people here as well.
David, in the last couple of minutes, I'm worried about the fact that we're seeing things like dropping out of the WHO and, you know, cuts to CDC. I feel like we're lowering our guard when it comes to public health. And without getting into too deeply into the politics of it, can you let us know, how does that affect us when we lower our guard regarding not participating, for example, in the World Health Organization, which we know is a community of public health specialists who communicate with each other as part of that community? How is that going to affect us?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, we live in a global society. We've talked about infections that we commonly think about as not being here in the U.S., things like tuberculosis. And if we don't support efforts to control these infections throughout the world, we're really not going to make the kind of headway that we want to see in keeping our American population healthy. And I do worry that, you know, as we you know, we have a lot of, from a public health perspective, we have a lot of things that we have to address. And infectious disease is one component of it. But if we start to let up on the infectious disease surveillance programs, the public health activities, you know, we will start to see diseases spread, and diseases that we haven't seen start to come back, you know, here in the U.S. and throughout the world. So, you know, I think, you know, these public health activities matter, supporting you know, public health organizations here in the U.S., like, you know, CDC and other, you know, state and local health departments, is really critical for our local surveillance. But we do have to keep a global perspective. And I think, you know, it's important to be mindful that while we are challenged with a lot of different public health priorities, keeping infectious diseases as an important one, I think, needs to be continued. So, you know, I always encourage folks to think globally when it comes to infectious diseases, because, you know, we don't have defined borders that help segregate infectious diseases. They are global, and we have to support the global systems that are designed to address them.
David, thank you. Thank you for your time today. And as always, sharing your knowledge with us and everything you do for the people in our community. Thank you, buddy.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Many thanks to our studio producer. Joey Burgoyne's been on the board today. Many thanks to Jeff Chandler, who's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week on Healthy Rounds, we're going to be talking about colon cancer, and we're getting ready for Colon Cancer Awareness Month. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast, and you download that free by going to Odyssey.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.